Hi, everybody. Welcome to Sweater Weather, a podcast about Canadian arts and culture. I'm Aaron Giovannone, a writer and professor.
And I'm Naomi Lewis, a writer and editor.
How are you doing, Naomi?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. How do you like our new digs?
I am very much enjoying our temporary creative retreat here in Montreal.
That's right. You may have noticed, audience at home there, or wherever you're watching, that we're not at our home.
No.
So, today we're talking about Generation X, a 1991 novel by Douglas Copeland, a Vancouver-based writer and visual artist.
Mm-hmm.
So, by way of introduction, should I say a couple of things about Generation X first? So, as I said, it was a 1991 book, and just say a couple of things. Like, Generation X refers to, of course, the generation born from 1965 to 1980, approximately.
I think that Douglas Copeland himself actually cut it off at 1978 for some reason.
Okay. I think the standard characterization of the generation is post-baby boom, post-baby boomers, which I guess stop at 65, and pre-millennials, which is 1980.
Although it's a murky, category, obviously.
As all generations are,
and
really.
Douglas Copeland never, in the novel or elsewhere, really comes out and says, like, this generation is a category, a phenomenon that I stand by. Like, and no one in the novel actually uses the term Generation X and talks about how it's their generation. He's more just kind of, I think, getting at how there were people in their 20s at that time who are still kind of considered boomers, but who didn't relate to a lot of the defining experiences that the actual boomers did. So they were distinct, he felt, in important ways from people 10 years older than them.
Right. So there was, around the time the novel came out in the early 90s, there was a lot of generational discourse around trying to describe this group of 20-somethings.
Mm-hmm.
Who were entering the labor market and had their own particular life experiences, particular to their moment in history, that were different than the baby boomers.
Mm-hmm.
And different names had been bandied about. Generation X, the one that Copeland uses in this novel, is the one that stuck.
Right.
That's the name that's stuck. Now, we'll get into about where that phrase Generation X comes from.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't invent it,
mm-hmm.
but he did. He was the first, I think, to apply it to this group of people, this particular generation, and it's the one that ended up being used ultimately.
Yes.
So now, what is the book about? And this is like a great question. We've already mentioned it's about 20-somethings. The book is written from the point of view of a narrator character named Andy, and it focuses on the lives of Andy and his two friends,
mm-hmm.
Claire and Dag, who all live as neighbors in bungalows in Palm Springs in their 20s or early 30s.
Yeah, and they have a shared courtyard with a pool. And
that's right. So they hang out there.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have previous knowledge of the book, previous experience of it, other kind of ideas before you reread it for today's episode?
Well, I definitely encountered it before. I remember when it came out, although I was younger, I guess, than the target audience, which was the same age as the characters in their 20s at the time,
mm-hmm.
and I was only 15 in mm-hmm. 1991. But I remember looking at it, whether that year or in a few years afterwards, a lot of kind of hip people had it in their houses.
That's right.
This book was often to be found on the shelves of people who probably, I don't know if they'd read it, but it was often found on the shelves of people who had like certain cultural artifacts as like markers of their subculture.
Yeah.
It was like a hipster thing to own, I guess.
Yeah, definitely.
And
or a Generation X thing to own.
It was very much a Generation X thing to own. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And I think that I remember it had a certain kind of different feel to it. It was a different shape. It was kind of rectangular horizontally.
Yeah. We don't have a physical copy.
Unfortunately.
We were reading PDFs and stuff, but it is a particular shape.
Yeah, and it has all this marginalia.
Yeah.
Where there'll be like a little, like, sort of definition of like a supposedly generational term in the margins. And then sometimes it'll have a sort of like statement or, what's the word? Phrase.
Yeah,
set
like,
off.
Like kind of a motto.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As
an example would be Trying to think.
Well, there's a cartoon at the beginning with a woman talking to her mother, right?
That's right.
And she's saying, oh, don't worry, mother. If the marriage doesn't work out, I can always get divorced.
That's right.
Yeah.
But that is like common.
And now that feels like, yeah, that's like just, it doesn't even seem ironic or like weird anymore, which is really funny.
I know, at the time I was like, what? You're planning on being able to divorce?
Yeah.
You know, in the 80s, divorce really started
to become... Like, is nothing sacred? People don't take anything seriously anymore.
I think if you look at the 80s, that's what the statistics show, like, divorce rates started to shoot up.
Yes.
And so, in the early 90s, this is still a new phenomenon that divorce should be considered.
And it was a big definitional thing about that generation. I mean, our generation and, you know, people 10, 15 years older that, like, their parents were divorced. Yeah, and it was a really new kind of thing. And there was a lot of talk about, like... how is all this divorce affecting children? Like, and you know, people no longer have the security of knowing that their family is going to stay intact. And then like blended families,
single parents,
yeah,
single moms especially.
Yeah.
Another name that had been used for this generation, sometimes still is latchkey kids.
Oh yeah.
Meaning kids who came home from school to an empty house and had to let themselves in.
Yeah, totally. Right. And like just kind of ran wild. And I mean, that was kind of my experience. A lot of people's experience is like you weren't supervised by your parents so much.
Right. Anything else about your sort of pre-episode experience of the book?
Just that I found it off-putting, actually. I remember trying to read it and just feeling like there was the quality to it that it was like trying to seem like a zine or something, I guess, with the layout and the kind of stuff like kind of inserted or like the kind of hipsterish design.
Yeah.
And then, and not that I was like against zines, but there was something just like so superficially hip about it, I felt. And then actually trying to read it, I found the story like impossible to get into. I just remember that feeling. And I mean, part of it was, I was like, okay, these people are 10 years older than me. Like, I'm 15. I cannot relate to 25-year-olds. Or, like, I'm 17. I cannot relate to 29-year-olds or whatever it was. Like, it was, I mean, these are,
so you're 15 when you're doing this.
15 to 16, 17, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
So the characters just seemed like weird, slackerish adults, like, who were kind of, like, supposedly lost. And I remember there was something in it. The one thing I remembered is there was something about a desert and something about like nuclear anxiety. Those are the two things.
Right.
So I must have read enough of it to know that. But I didn't get much further than that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you?
Well, I actually have a rather long anecdote about this. Okay. Let's hear it. I hope it's not too long. I did like in high school, probably maybe more, actually maybe more like early university. Yes, this was a hip book to read. I was like trying to be a writer. This was a writerly kind of book to read. Douglas Copeland also being Canadian and me trying to be a Canadian writer. I'm like, okay, this is a book I really should read. So yeah, I think I had a copy. I must have had a copy at some point. And I tried to read it, and I really didn't get much out of it.
Mm.
But I just thought the problem was me.
Yeah.
Because I was young and inexperienced, and this is a popular, important book, so I've been told. So if it doesn't make sense, I'm the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So cut to a few years later, and after university, I had a foray, a kind of a ill-advised foray to France.
Oh, yes.
I was trying to learn French even back then.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do something cool and cultural. And after finishing a degree in English literature, I didn't really have awesome job opportunities immediately jumping out at me.
Right.
This is 2002. This is the fall of 2002. So I went with a friend to Paris and thought, okay, well, we'll get jobs teaching ESL and we'll just hang out here for a while. Now, this is a very Gen X thing to do. I mean, the characters in the book are actually doing something rather similar. They don't know what to do with themselves.
To be fair, they have quit lucrative jobs in order to run off.
Right.
They just were boring and soul-sucking jobs, but they were stable and well-paid jobs.
You know, I could have had a boring, soul-sucking job in Canada. Mm-hmm. Instead, I got one in Paris very briefly.
Okay.
So it was similar. I was motivated by a similar desire to have and then personally enriching a cultural experience that, yes, it would be be less rewarding financially, but more personally rewarding. Now, this was, okay, lots of good things ultimately came of this experience, but it was a terrible time. Like, it was a very brutal 4 months. I was only there for 4 months. Okay. It's amazing thinking back because it seemed like forever. Things went so poorly.
Yeah,
we couldn't really find apartment to live in together. We had to rent rooms in separate houses. It was costing a fortune for the time. Getting paid very little. We did get jobs teaching ESL, but we're being paid peanuts. We had hardly any hours. So it was like really hard scraping by. And much like the characters in the book, you kind of are relying on the fact that you have middle-class parents to fall back on. Either you know you can go back to your house and go back to your old room and you won't starve and
you'll
have
even though you really don't want to.
Even though you don't want to, you can do it. And also if you need, like, you know, I didn't make a habit of borrowing money from my mom, but I did borrow money from my mom in Paris because I couldn't make rent for the first couple of months. So I was doing a very Gen X thing.
Yes.
And one day, I'm very lonely there too. I have one friend. One day I noticed, I don't know how I found out about it, that Douglas Copeland himself was doing an event at the Canadian Embassy in Paris.
Oh.
So I lived in the 7th arrondissement, which is like very near Napoleon's tomb.
Okay.
Napoleon's tomb is funny. If you ever see it, it's a humongous coffin. It's in wood. Mm-hmm. It's huge.
Okay.
And it's funny for reported, like reputedly small men. Anyway, that's probably a historical fallacy. Yes. Wasn't that small, but that's an aside.
Well, no, I don't think it is, but yeah,
go on. The Canadian Embassy was just over the river, so it was like a 15-minute walk. Mm-hmm. So I go. I go to this event. Now, the Canadian Embassy is a big, fancy building. The doors are like splayed open, and I'm like feeling very much like an imposter, like going here.
Okay.
I don't know, is it like, should I be trying to speak French here or should I be speaking English or something? These are always the constant language anxiety. Mm. At the time for me, it was because I was trying to learn French, didn't want to seem stupid, didn't want to seem like a dumb tourist, you know? It's shiny, it's glittery. I've at this age, I'm an old hand now at literary events, but at this age, I don't think I'd really gone to many.
Sure, it can be intimidating.
Very intimidating. So I walk in there and there's champagne and there's hors d'oeuvres. And I'm like, I'm wearing my work clothes. You know what I mean? Like these like corny dress pants with like a button
Did
up.
Did you stuff your pockets with hors d'oeuvres?
No, I ate a lot. Good. And I ate a lot and I had definitely had a couple glasses of champagne for free.
Nice.
And then I'm like terrified of talking to anybody because everybody there is like in their 40s.
Right.
And so... Like, I don't think I even talked to anybody. I, like, very assiduously, like, avoided conversation. And then this event happens. So we're let into some other room. And it is, like, a big, fancy Parisian, like, room. And Douglas Copeland is sitting at a table. And there's another guy sitting at a table. And it is not at all clear who this other guy is. But he is a French speaker.
Okay.
There are maybe this. And I was also surprised by how few people were there. Okay. There was only like 20 people.
Okay.
Or maybe 30 people. And I thought to myself, Douglas Copeland, isn't he a big, important, like internationally known author?
Yeah.
Nobody gave a shit, really. Okay. It's another thing I realized now. I was like, oh yeah, writers don't really get that much attention. So, they start talking, and they're speaking in English. Mm-hmm. The other man speaks very poor English. So this is part of the problem. But they talk for 15 minutes, and it is not at all clear what they're talking about. Because this is not, I expected this to be a reading, a literary reading. It was not a literary reading, nor was it an interview, because the one fellow wasn't really at ease in English and couldn't talk that well. Nor was it any kind of a presentation. All they did, they literally talked about stuff, referring to a few names along the way that they never explained.
Were they talking in English or
French? Was in English. Okay. It was all in English. Another detail, I was wearing my work clothes. Like I was always I had to very carefully iron my shirts every day.
Yeah.
And it was like a lot of work. And I remember this one detail of Douglas Copeland, who's in his early 40s at the time.
Yeah.
He was wearing this ridiculously wrinkled sports jacket.
Okay.
And I was looking at it and it was so ugly. And I was like, this looks terrible.
Was it linen?
It may have been a linen jacket. It may have been one of those jackets that for a brief time it was like in fashion to have something wrinkly. Do you remember this period? There was a brief period where in Europe, because I saw this later in Italy, men were wearing wrinkled shirts.
Interesting.
You've never seen that, eh?
I don't remember.
Okay, so I don't know. At the time, I wasn't familiar with this fashion, if it was indeed the fashion. So I remember thinking, this guy literally just pulled a jacket out of his backpack and put it on. Like, he didn't even, like, prepare for this at all. Like, he didn't even, like...
So you're offended.
I was, like, offended, like, that clearly... Again, I was young and naive.
Yeah.
Clearly, there had been no preparation for this event at all.
Right, right.
Like, the two guys were not even, they had not even decided what they were going to do.
And meanwhile, he didn't even iron his shirt.
He didn't even iron his shirt. Meanwhile, I come in always so worried because I was teaching English to business people, right? So, okay.
So, not a good impression.
15 minutes go by. Okay. Nobody is understanding. If I'm not understanding, no one else is understanding.
Yeah. Are you sure?
It was not at all. They were making vague references to an art project. Never was it explained what the art project was or what it was about or anything.
Wow.
It
sounds like a nightmare.
It was
a literal nightmare.
In retrospect, as I said, they just were not prepared. It's easy enough. People like have to rush to a lecture or to give a talk, and they just, you know, they didn't have time to prepare. This is a very standard. This is like something that happens quite a bit.
Yeah, well, it shouldn't. I feel like I can come down and say that it's not really okay to do that, but all right.
They turn around, they go, okay, well, clearly they ran out of gas talking about nothing.
Yeah.
And they go, oh, are there any questions? Like, after 15 minutes. In retrospect, I'm like, this is the most laziest slacker.
Did anyone ask a question? Like, what are you talking about?
Naomi, nobody asks a question, okay? Again, naive Aaron, 22 years old.
You asked a question.
I stand up to ask a question. And I think I'm helping.
Yeah, right.
These lazy sons of bitches who couldn't have been bothered to prepare a proper 30 minutes or something, right? I think I'm helping these guys. I stand up and I say something along these lines. I say, so I've been here listening. And I can't really figure out what you're talking about. Like, are you promoting an art show that you've done together?
You said that.
Yes.
Nice.
And Copeland was totally offended. He, like, first of all, I'm the only one who said anything. But he gets mad at me. His, like, face, like, scrunched up, like, like angrily. And he says in an aggressively joking tone, this poor guy sitting here the whole time had no idea what was going on. It's my fault.
Yeah.
Of course, he knows very well. Again, in retrospect, he knows very well that he's prepared nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've told us nothing interesting. Yeah. And nobody cares because they don't understand and they have no questions.
I guess he assumed that everyone already knew, like, about his project because he was so famous that he didn't even need to explain it.
Could there be anything more, first of all, slacker? Second of all, like, self-importance.
Yeah, I mean,
these are some of the worst qualities of Gen X, right?
Right.
And so that was my experience.
Nicely brought around to the point there.
After that, Douglas Copeland himself, like, lost some of his fascination for me, and I really stopped paying attention to him. Mm. Already by the early 2000s, he had transitioned, I think, a little more into being a visual artist.
Mm-hmm.
He still writes books here and there.
Oh, yeah, he's put out quite a few.
Mm-hmm. But I would say after the 90s, they don't really get as much attention as before. So I really didn't think about Douglas Copeland. I hadn't thought of Douglas Copeland since that moment in 2002.
Okay.
And so here we are coming back to Generation X.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so many years later. He was born in 1961. This is actually outside of the traditionally defined parameters of Generation X, being 65 being when they're supposed to begin. But anyway, so an older member, like the oldest of Generation X, right?
Although, can I just add that the characters in the book are said to be 30 or 30-ish, so they are exactly the same age as he is.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right. So we could say older members of Generation X.
I mean, that's assuming that the book is supposed to take place in the same year as it was published.
I think so.
We can assume
there's like no attempt at historical periodization or something.
Right.
So Douglas Coben is born in 1961 on a Canadian forces base in West Germany. His father was a doctor in the military. And just a few years later, he moved the family back to Canada, where they settled in Vancouver.
Okay.
So his mother was a housewife, but she was, you know, she had a degree in comparative religion from McGill. Douglas was the second of four sons in the family. Now, he briefly attended McGill University himself. He went there to study science, but he came back to Vancouver after a year, where he then enrolled in fine art at Emily Carr University. Okay. He graduated in 1984. He did some more courses abroad. He went to Milan. He went to Sapporo, Japan. And he stayed in Japan for a while as a designer. I guess he was working in Tokyo. But he returned to Vancouver again after a few years. So there's this kind of yo-yoing, I think, back and forth. So apparently, while he was in Japan, he sent a postcard to a friend in Vancouver. That friend's husband was an editor at Vancouver Magazine. It was a new magazine at the time. It's still going. It's a lifestyle magazine. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of glossy magazine that has a bunch of ads for restaurants and, mm-hmm. and shops. And that every city has one of those, right? And so this editor husband saw the postcard, liked the writing, and offered Copeland a job when he was back in Vancouver.
Like as a staff writer or something?
I don't know. I'm not sure if it was a staff writer or just like a regular freelancer. In the late 80s, you're getting paid a lot more to write for a magazine.
Wow, if only life were like that.
Yeah, you're getting paid a lot more probably to write as a freelancer. I'm sure at the time they didn't think they were being paid well.
Yeah.
But boy, if they could have seen the future.
Yeah.
So that's how he became a writer. He wrote freelance for a few other Canadian magazines as well. Now in 87, he wrote an article for Vancouver Magazine that was titled Generation X. Mm. This was nonfiction. It was like supposed to be like witty aperçus describing people his own age, what defined their lives. And he says that in that article, he says, Generation X, quote, denotes a large chunk of the population ignored because its members have no money and because the baby boomers outnumber them. Mm-hmm. So that's how he defines Generation X. And he also he continued on this theme of Generation X for other articles he did. He wrote for a short-lived business magazine in Toronto. It was called Vistas. And he did a series of cartoons. Mm-hmm. About Generation X. Okay. So cartoons like those that appear in the book as well. So now...
I see.
Yeah. So where does the term Generation X actually come from? As I said before, Copeland popularized it, but he didn't invent it. British sociologist Jane Deverson and Charles Hamblett published a book of sociology in 1964. That was called Generation X. It was trying to explain the youth culture of the 1960s.
Oh.
Punk rocker Billy Idol was in a band called Generation X from 1976 to 1981.
Okay.
Now, in his original Gen X article for Vancouver Magazine, Copeland references Billy Idol. So he's acknowledging that he's getting the term from Billy Idol. Okay. But a few years after Generation X was published, the book, in 1995, Copeland actually kind of negated what he had earlier written about the source of Generation X as a term, where he got it. He claimed that he got it, the idea, from a book of like funny pop sociology that was called Class, A Guide Through the American Status System. It's a book from 1983 by Paul Fussell, who was an English professor and a writer. This is a book that actually a lot of people read. I think it's like a really short book. It's like 150 pages. And it's like, it's like funny, it's like witticisms, witty observations about how the class and status system work in the United States. Now, what's interesting about this book, because I've read it, like the book largely defines the upper and the middle and the lower classes, like according to taste. So it's not a serious book of economic like analysis, but it talks about the cultural preferences and social behaviors of these different classes.
Okay.
So he's not talking about economics really. Now, Copeland says of the final chapter in that book that Fussell, he names an X category of people who were not of any class, who wanted to, this is a quote from Copeland, wanted to hop off the merry-go-round of status, money, and social climbing that so often frames modern existence.
Okay.
So that's who he named the book after. So I went back and read this last chapter of Paul Fussell. And indeed, what he's describing as these X people are people who are modern bohemians. They're people who don't want to spend their money on flashy cars or big houses, but on cultural experiences instead. These are people who, I would say, these are people whose like consumption practices are like limited in quantity, but like in high quality, right? So people, again, in his version of class, this is a kind of person with a certain kind of taste.
Yeah.
So these are people with cultural tastes.
A certain kind of style, yeah.
That's right. So that's what Copeland says was his influence for thinking about Generation X, how he defined it. And indeed, you can see that is exactly the kind of people in this book, Generation X, absolutely. In the novel, right? I would just say one more thing about this Paul Fussell's book is that it is like very funny and it's elegantly written. And like, I would recommend it to anybody, but like, it really never comments like at all about, especially talking about these X people, but like where their money might come from, as if just because you're not consuming as much, you don't have to like acknowledge that, well, the money does still, you still need some money,
don't you?
So, you know, clearly when you're reading the book, you're thinking, okay, but these people, where their money come from? It's like, okay, well, they must have inheritance like from parents, either like past, present, or future, or because of the time this book is written, like maybe they enjoy the kind of the safety net of the welfare state of the time, of that time, where the cost of living was relatively low, where wages were relatively high, and you could just work, maybe you could just work a little bit, and like maybe have enough to get by on that.
Well, the way that Douglas Copeland illustrates that whole phenomenon in the novel is that the characters quit their 9-to-5 office jobs and they, but they do have jobs. They have what he calls McJobs, but like their McJobs are, you know, working in a store, working as a bartender, which are seen as like McJobs because they have no future, no security, blah, blah, blah. They're jobs that like seem like not that crazy to us now or not that kind of hair-raising because so many people live that way. But the idea of just like having a job in order to earn enough to do the things you want to do was kind of revolutionary, I guess.
I mean, today it's normal to have a university degree and work in a service job.
Totally.
Incredibly normal. Back then it was like, oh, can you believe that we're doing this?
It was a choice. It wasn't because they couldn't find another job. It was because they had decided that they didn't want to be part of that system. And there's still people who do that. Like you said, like like you could have gotten an office job after your English degree, probably. I mean,
could have.
Yeah. And I mean, the kinds of jobs that the characters are described as having that they quit, like I've had jobs like that and they are like horrible. Like going to an office, having kind of
they can be
mindless
tough.
Work, having to wear kind of, you know, like
an uncomfortable iron shirt every day.
Yeah. And there being this kind of stale air conditioned air and the like cubicle and the
Velcro cubicle stuff.
Yeah. And the like fluorescent lights and those.
No wonder people don't want to go back to the office.
Yeah.
I mean, really. Now, Copeland, he was working as a magazine writer. So he got a Toronto-based literary agent, Peter Livingston, and he pitched and sold the idea of a handbook, a guide to understanding this new young generation, Generation X. So St. Martin's Press in the United States gave him a $15,000 or $20,000 advance to write the book. This was in 1989. That was the American publisher. There was a Canadian would-be publisher called Seal Books. They would not publish it in the end. But he did have an American and a Canadian publisher lined up. Now, with this money, Copeland bought a 1971 Volkswagen and moved to a bungalow in Palm Springs, California. That wealthy resort town on the on the edge of the desert. This is where he was writing the first draft of the book.
And it just happens to be set there as well.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. What, okay, now when he was in Palm Springs, he actually ended up scrapping the idea of it being a handbook and instead wrote fiction And like, that's a huge change.
Yeah.
So what do you think about the Palm Springs setting for the book? Why is it important or interesting, do you think?
Well, I get he chose it partly because he was living there.
Well, but he chose to live there wrote the book.
Right. And I mean, the way that it's described at the time is like, it's, and I don't think this is the case anymore, like it's way more of a wealthy resort town now where like celebrities hang out and stuff.
Yeah.
But it was a bit of a ghost town at the time. It wasn't as fancy as it is now, it sounds like. It was like a little bit scuzzy.
I think it has its scuzzy parts in the book, but there's also really wealthy people there. So this is, I think, a failure of the book is it doesn't describe the city in any
evocative detail. Yeah, I don't feel like I can really picture it. I don't feel like I can really picture it.
But there are rich people hanging around. Like, they're just... Anyway, go ahead.
Sort of rich, though. Like, I don't know if they're supposed to be, like, soup. Like, there's not, like, celebrities hanging around. There's, like, one of the characters first shows up with her enormous family, and they're all on vacation there. It seems like more of, like, a middle-class destination. It's not, like, an upper-middle-class destination. But... anyway, be that as it may, it's kind of an exotic locale, being in the desert, being extremely hot, having this kind of wasteland feel to it, as he describes it.
Yeah.
And maybe it's like it seems like it's supposed to be somewhere like odd for a young person to land, because mm-hmm. it's mostly retired people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there's a kind of like rebelliousness in that they haven't gone somewhere hip, they've gone somewhere... unexpected. And meanwhile, it's like a desert, so it's a metaphor, right? It's like a desert of the soul that they're all all experiencing. A dearth of culture, a dearth of meaning, a dearth of everything, really, of a future that they can aim for and picture.
Yeah, I think to get his argument across, because again, this begins as a nonfiction book trying to inform the audience about the travails of this young cohort.
Mm-hmm.
Setting it in Palm Springs is a chance to do two things for me. Is one, to show, because it is like a resort town, you see that like the young protagonists are in this place where there's like wealthier older people. Mm-hmm. So we see these young people like in service to their out of touch elders, basically. Mm-hmm. So they're poorer, there's poorer and they have to serve them. And then it's also a chance, because it is a cultural desert as well as a literal desert, the way that's depicted in the book, to show the Xers' cultural superiority to the old people around them. They say things like this all the time, everything's tacky and everything's in poor taste. Mm-hmm. And they like to kind of laugh at that, right? So there's like a quote in here at one point where the narrator, main character Andy, he's speaking about his boss and wife, who are boomers, they're mm-hmm. older, and he says this: "The two of them are sweet. They're of the generation that believes that steakhouses should be dimly lit and frostily chilled. Hell, they actually believe in steakhouses."
Right.
So how dare these people? I mean, these people, like, okay, rolling your eyes at the people who like steakhouses.
Right.
You know?
And that's such a Generation X quality, is the eye roll, the kind of like, and the kind of love of tacky things.
So
ironically,
so like, you can roll your eyes.
Yeah. Like, your whole life is an eye roll, right? I mean, I've talked about this before on this podcast, but I feel like in the 90s, I bought into that so hard that it was like I required like a sort of like a long recovery afterwards. But that everything's ironic. Everything is. Like, you taking anything seriously is kind of sickening and embarrassing and setting yourself up to look like an idiot, right?
Yes, because someone will make fun of you. Someone else will make fun of you.
Yes, if you dare to take anything seriously.
So, hence the birth of the slacker persona. What, nothing's worth trying.
Yeah.
You're trying too hard for, right?
Yeah, trying too hard is so lame, right?
Yeah. So.
And it means that you're trying to be part of something is actually malevolent, which is this like consumer culture.
Now, speaking of trying too hard, it was too hard to write a book of nonfiction, which required research. This is what I feel happened partly.
Hey, writing a novel is not easy, y'all.
Well, writing this novel was probably pretty easy. Shots fired. This is like such an easy book. Yeah. It was written in eight months.
Really? Okay, yeah, I can
so
see that.
We're gonna maybe dig into this a little bit more. But so he sent the manuscripts to the publishers, they weren't happy. Seal Books, the Canadian publisher, dropped it. The American publisher, St. Martin's, they took a long time to respond, but eventually they did agree to publish it.
Okay.
I read that there was a debate among the staff there. The younger staffers thought they advocated for the book more than the older ones did. So the book was published in early 1991. Now, the reception to it was really kind of muted at first and slow. Mm-hmm. So, but like after about 6 months, so I think we're in the summer of 91, the book begins to gain some traction and appear on some lists, like got some more reviews. Now, it ended up like by the end of 1991, it was on the Globe and Mail's bestsellers list, and it stayed there for a year.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, one of the reasons why this book is so popular, it's very, I guess we haven't used the word zeitgeisty yet, but it is very much like of its cultural moment. As I said earlier, there was a lot of generational discourse being bandied around in the press. In 1990, Time magazine, they published a big feature about the travails of people they called 20-somethings. Mm-hmm. They hadn't named it X yet. And that was a big, big article. People talked a lot about that. There was a cottage industry, you know, already appealing to trying to like define, understand, and market to this new demographic. You know, marketers are always looking for like what's the next new demographic to target. And so in the early 90s, 90, 91, 92, for the first few years of the 90s, it was Generation X. And so Douglas Copeland like really came in at the right moment with this book. What else is going on in the early 90s? Well, stuff that would come to define the culture of this period. Grunge music is gearing up. Nirvana's Nevermind came out in 1991, the same year.
Right.
Richard Linklater's movie Slacker, did you ever see that? That came out in 1990.
Okay.
And another thing that's happening in this moment is that there is an economic recession in the early 90s. So this affected younger workers more than their older counterparts because they already have secure jobs with maybe seniority or savings, and younger workers do not. So there's this kind of woe is me feeling for these younger professionals who find themselves without work in the early 90s. So that's what's going on with Generation X when it comes out. We've talked a little bit about the book object. Now, we were laughing about it being easy to write. Partly it's because it's very short. It's 183 pages in a very strange format. I'm sure the word count is even less than you'd expect for a 183 page book, would be my guess.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's a weird shape. We talked about it already.
There's not very many words on each page.
There are not many words in this book. And in the end, if that was easier for the writer, we're fine with it because it's easier for the reader as well. Now, it's an infuriating novel to read, says a reviewer in the Montreal Mirror in 1991. It's wide as a textbook and its pages flop in the middle like wet Wonder Bread.
Yeah. The pages were floppy. I remember that.
It's so hard. You can't even read this thing.
Like there's a heavy spine that makes it like
you can't
flop
open.
Around.
You couldn't open this book, right?
Yeah.
Remember that the book began as a nonfiction manual, and so fragments of that handbook idea are still there.
So that's the marginalia.
There's a running glossary with footnotes throughout presenting like phrases that are really just neologisms of Douglas
Copeland.
Well,
some of them I wondered about that because I thought, okay, did he make this up or did he hear it somewhere?
I think he made up McJob.
Did he
I
make
think
that
he
up?
Coined that
because that did become a term that people use.
I believe he actually coined that one.
Okay.
He didn't coin Generation X, as we said. There's things like, oh, poverty jet set.
Yeah.
Like describing themselves as the poverty jet set, like, okay, yeah, people who spend what income they have on travel or whatever.
Yeah.
So
did he make that up or did he hear it somewhere? Like,
gloss? I don't know that particular one.
Yeah, we don't know.
But the glossary overall is those words, phrases, they're his inventions.
Okay, so you know that for sure.
I've read that.
Okay.
So they're not phrases that I've really heard anywhere else.
Me neither, but they could have just been like phrases that were going around among, you know, a small set of people.
They're presented. I mean, that's a fictional presentation.
Yeah, that is
to present them in a way that
this is a phrase. What the kids are saying,
and it's
days.
Not. It's okay, just what okay, he's okay. saying. Yeah, and these like this running glossary are kind of like you can even think of it as a kind of a running commentary on the novel at times because they appear where maybe someone in the book and in the story is doing something about a McJob or whatever that would suggest. So this is not an impoverished living experience.
No, and they have like a car that he has two dogs.
Yeah.
Like they can afford their lives.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
But they're not, they don't have, you know, job security. They don't know what they're going to do with the rest of their lives. Like their situations are not sustainable because like they're very educated, but they have service jobs. So they haven't, yeah. they've kind of like in a way dropped out, you know, mm-hmm. and,
yeah.
and they're doing this kind of, they're in this kind of intermission in their own lives that they're enacting together and they're trying to find some kind of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree, the novel, I mean, as you've been indicating, is not a very good novel. From a literary standpoint, it's like quite thin.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite hard to get into. Like, we both struggled to read it when we were young. But like, coming back to it, like, I agree with you. Like, this novel is just not very, it's not very compelling. And it's not very profound in the ways that it tries to be.
Yeah.
But... and the characters are like very thinly drawn. The main character, Andy, like, can you even picture Andy? Like,
no one's ever really described the characters. Yeah. All the characters speak in the exact same way.
Yeah.
And they're never really described in any evocative, memorable way. So you can never picture them,
mm-hmm.
but you can never picture the setting really ever either. Mm-hmm. So it really works against you really, you know, grokking like, this is what these people are like and the differences from each other. It takes a lot of skill to draw delineate a character,
oh, yeah.
right? Or like, describe an evocative setting. And like, this is the slacker vibe of the book. It's like, he's not even trying.
Yeah, not think. Really.
Yeah.
So Andy, he has these two dogs. He never says what kinds of dogs they are, what breed, what gender, whether they're the same as each other, nothing. Their names, nothing, nothing. And the dogs seem to kind of sometimes be there as this presence, like there's dog hair on his clothes or whatever, but somehow I forgot that the dogs even existed.
Oh, many times.
But yeah. But also, the book is in three sections. There's the first section where these three friends are basically telling each other stories of their own invention, but are somehow like metaphors for their own ennui or like,
right. So many prevails. So there's not really a through line. Like nothing really happens.
Not in that first section. Then in the second section, it becomes more about them, but like very little happens.
I think it's fair to say throughout the entire book, there is not a satisfying plot that has cause and effect where this happens and then this happens because of it. And that's like, this is a very hard thing to write, is a plot that's compelling and that seems... It's compelling and it seems like it's all connected.
But they do each have sort of some rising action, some kind of conflict in their life.
Yes.
Like runs away and comes back. Claire pursues a guy who's not into her and comes back. And Andy goes home for Christmas and comes back.
Yeah.
And both of them, all of them have to suffer through some kind of like minor strife.
Which doesn't really seem to impact them. At all. They just seem like the same level of perturbment the entire time.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's just like, you're not really seeing that cause and effect that makes a story compelling, right? Like something happens and that changes the person.
Then there's this really, they take off for Mexico and then there's this baffling epilogue that seems to take place 10 years later,
mm-hmm.
which is bizarre. Mm-hmm. Like I find that epilogue, like in a way, it's the most compelling part of the book. In the epilogue, it seems to be 10 years later
because
it's New Year's, like it's New Year's Eve the day before, and then it's New Year's Day, but it says New Year's Day 2000.
Yeah.
But he's in the same place. He's still like near the California-Mexico border,
mm-hmm.
driving around, and he comes across this field. He thinks he sees a nuclear blast, but it turns out it's just farmers burning the stubble off their fields, and there's all these black smoking fields, farm fields.
Mm-hmm.
And these tourists have all stopped their cars and are like looking at the weird black fields.
Yeah.
And then this beautiful white bird comes down and like sits on the black field.
An egret. And flying by, it actually scrapes him.
Right.
By accident, scrapes his forehead.
And then a school bus has stopped full of cognitively impaired teenagers.
Yeah.
And they all are like delighted by this bird.
Yeah.
And they're the only ones who are as delighted as like openly joyful as he is.
Yeah.
And then they all run over and hug him. And he has this kind of moment of transcendence. And I mean, this scene is incredibly reminiscent of The Catcher in the Rye.
Oh, is it?
Okay. Yeah. Where he talks about like his ultimate like, and I mean, this comes up in the book actually, where they're like, what is like the most beautiful moment you can imagine? What is the one thing that you wish you could experience? What is like your best moment on earth?
Yeah.
And Holden Caulfield in The Catcher in the Rye talks about his best moment that he could possibly have being like, he pictures himself in a field of rye, like at the edge of a cliff, and all these children are running towards the cliff and he's catching them. So that's why it's called The Catcher in the Rye, is like that he wants to be the person that like stops the kids from running over the edge of the cliff.
Right. Okay. So,
and so this kind of encounter with innocence, and I mean, it's not exactly the same, obviously not exactly the same. Andy is sort of like absorbed into the innocence. He's not like the barrier between the innocence and corruption or whatever, but like, I somehow, this book reminded me of a lot of other books, and I feel like maybe that's not an accident, because he's talking about this like postmodernist pastiche, like fragmentary style that these characters have of like bringing in styles from different decades and smushing them all together. And he seems to kind of have like, not just like, it's not just reminiscent, like it seems to have like outright allusions to books like The Catcher in the Rye and On the Road and The Great Gatsby and what was the other one I was thinking of? The Sun Also Rises, like also books about like that are explicitly about like people, young people who feel, who believe that their generation has gone to hell and it's like the older generation's fault and they've been left behind and like they're of the last generation, or like the B generation, or the, you know, whatever generation, which is basically about like choosing to not participate in like the system that their parents are fully absorbed in, the system that is not working very well for them, and that they therefore just leave and refuse to participate in, and instead enjoy either or fail to enjoy either a life of like melancholy and alienation, or like idealism and hedonism, but like, or a kind of a mixture of both, but sort of a gang of friends who are all in it together.
Right.
And there's like road trips, and there's, you know, exploration of what it means to be American, even though Douglas Copeland is Canadian. And, you know, sort of forays into romance that go awry, and attempts to engage with like normies or whatever, like Claire does when she tries to date a yuppie.
His name's Tobias. So there's a very rich and very hunky guy named Tobias who he's dating Claire. He doesn't fit in with the Xer slackers, because he's actually happy to be to like work corporate jobs and to get rich in New York, because he doesn't believe in anything else. He's quite cynical about it, but he's like, well, why wouldn't I do this? Because it's like the thing to do.
But he also acknowledges like he was attracted to her in the first place because she was this rebellious dropout.
She was different.
But then he realizes like, I don't want to give up these things that I've worked so hard to attain, and I want to continue to attain them, and I don't want to be part of this like earnest, mystical type experience that you're having in the desert.
Well, ironic, mystical type.
Yeah, experience. But it's both ironic and mystical, because they are all trying to have these kind of sublime, transcendent moments.
They're living for an experience. They're living for an aesthetic, aesthetically overwhelming moment. So they are like essentially living for those moments. Mm-hmm. The rest of the, and this is why the novel ends with such a moment where it's like a stark black field and a brilliantly white egret, and it's their contrast that is this like amazing scene that stops traffic and that stops Andy as well. And that it makes sense that this novel would culminate with just a random aesthetic experience, right? Whereas, you know, everything else hasn't amounted to much, right? Like, so the rest of the novel is them, like much of the is them just having like random little adventures, like side quests, and telling each other little parables,
stories,
which are just like, oh, this is like a fun little ditty that will entertain us that the characters tell each other to entertain themselves for mm-hmm. an afternoon, much like it's supposed to entertain the reader just for those couple of pages.
Although I also think like that last epilogue is important because of the nuclear. It brings up that nuclear anxiety that he thinks it's a nuclear blast.
Right.
Throughout the novel, the characters are all, you know, especially the one character, Dag, the specter of nuclear war is still hanging over them. The Cold War is like just ended, and the kind of ongoing nuclear anxiety has been a prominent feature for their entire lives, right? And I think it's no coincidence that at the end he thinks he sees a nuclear blast, and it turns out to be this benign, mm-hmm. Beautiful, like agricultural yeah. and nature filled yeah. moment.
Somebody else working.
Yeah, yeah.
And you and your like infinite leisure just get to drive by.
Yeah, well, that's true too. But I think that the nuclear the theme of nuclear anxiety throughout the book mm-hmm. is really interesting. Mm-hmm. Like that's one thing that is actually interesting is like that this is such a big part of that age group's childhood, which was not really part of our childhood 10 years later,
no,
right?
I didn't worry about that stuff.
And then also another interesting thing to me was how Andy remembers the Vietnam War as a feature of his childhood mm-hmm. that suddenly ended, like that permeated everything.
Right, right.
And that suddenly ended when he was like 9 or something, right?
Right, yeah.
And when people differentiate between Generation X and the boomers, or when Copeland did, he talked about how for the boomers, like Vietnam in the States again, like kind of defined everything.
Yeah.
Defined them as a generation. And for people born like in the early 60s, it was a childhood memory that mm-hmm. they didn't really understand, that wasn't really part of who they were in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And then without the Vietnam War, and then without even the threat of nuclear attack from Russia, like, what are we left with to hold on to as our identity? The kind of, like, sudden, apparent absence, supposed absence of all conflict. And meanwhile, the kind of vapidity of what is expected from you in daily life, which is that, like, go to work to earn enough money to buy stuff that you don't really need, and then...
Right.
You need to keep working to pay for that stuff, and mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you're living in a big house that you never have time to be in, and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons people saw continuity originally between boomers and Xers, like, oh, these are just young boomers,
mm-hmm.
is because they actually have certain values in common. One of them being, I would say, when you said the phrase drop out, like I was thinking of Timothy Leary.
Of course, that's a Timothy Leary.
Right, it's a really, these are hippies. Like, this what's going on
Well, they
here.
Don't use the phrase drop out. I was using that in reference to Timothy
But
Leary.
They're dropping out. I mean, they're dropping out insofar as they can, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what's happening with these Xers in this book is that they are living a life that the hippies had, that their boomer parents had when they were young, but without the optimism.
Well, without a goal, without an idea.
Yeah, they don't think, because they see what happened with the boomers, and they okay, well, that all that change and progress led to just a life of either like drudgery at a job, and or just consumerism, mm-hmm. Environmental destruction, all of these things.
And like cultural symbols that used to hold weight and now have just become kind of empty kitsch.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But, like, I also think that there's a big difference in the dropping out of these people and the dropping out of their parents or people, you know, 20 years before,
yeah.
30 years before. And that they don't drop out to go and join a commune. They don't have a guru.
No.
They don't have, like, acid trips where they all sit around and, like, have epiphanies.
They drop out to write a novel.
Well, no. Douglas Copeland drops out to write a novel.
Yeah.
These people are doing nothing.
Yeah.
The characters in the book are doing nothing.
But they end up, I guess where they end up is that they move to a place where it's even cheaper to live, Mexico, and they say they're going to, this is something action we never see, they're going to manage a motel together. So that's their final destination, is just live someplace where it's cheap. Why is it important for it to be cheap? Because they're living off of money they've saved or their parents' money, right? So this is, why does it matter that you live in Mexico versus living somewhere else?
But they're planning to start a business that's to earn money.
Yeah, but they want to live somewhere cheap as well. Yeah, they're going to be small business owners, yeah, right? So the way that I read Generation X, this kind of Generation X, because actually the book does a good job of showing a different kind of Xer, which is that guy Tobias, who's actually a careerist.
Right.
He's a totally cynical careerist. That is another face of Generation X.
Yes.
That is very important to realize that, because actually if you look around today, people in positions of power are Generation X. They're the, you know, they're the Prime Minister of Canada, Prime Minister of Britain. I mean, Obama was an Xer. Mm-hmm. I think he was considered like the first Xer president.
Right.
And so there was a careerist version of a Generation X person, for sure. And so we do see that on the periphery of this novel.
Well, I mean, in order to drop out, you have to be dropping out from what most people are doing. So by definition, like, there cannot be a whole generation.
Yeah, a whole generation dropping out.
Yeah,
it can't be. So what these Xers are they're bohemians. They're kind of wannabe artists or living an artistic, aesthetically driven lifestyle.
Where they're in On the Road or The Sun Also Rises.
Exactly. But those are, those are connected to a progressive vision of what America can be. Attached to like a kind of liberal nationalist vision, in fact, that is collective. This is not. I mean, by the 90s, there's like no belief in that. We understand that those things are not going to... There's a total cynicism about these kind of collective projects.
Right.
At the end of the Cold War, you're like, fighting against communism for these 40 years or whatever. Mm. And now we won. And now what are we doing with our victory? We're just going to keep doing consumerism and do more and more of it, right? So that's something that defines the 90s as well, is that a loss of purpose because of the end of the Cold War that is, it's resonating for these characters in just the sense of having no goal beyond, some kind of enjoyment wherever you can find it, but with the cynical knowledge of how much of this is pointless.
I think that an image that kept coming up in the book that I just found so somehow telling was liposuction. It comes up right at the beginning where Andy says that his dogs have been eating liposuction fat.
So gross.
And he describes like their snouts being covered in yuppie fat. And
oh,
he has
come
to, like,
on.
No, but seriously, it's one of the first images
gross.
In the book.
It's so gross.
And then it comes up like at least two more times that he talks about liposuction fat.
I know.
And there's just, like, he's really quite, like, horrified by and somehow sees it as a poem symbol, like, that...
Of age. I think it's, like, kind of an ageism of these characters, too, right?
But they call it yuppie fat, like, yuppie lipo fat. And, yeah, like, the characters aren't old enough yet to have, like to want liposuction, so there's that for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also just something, like, I don't know, I just think there's something... Like, he's saying that people who would pay money to get their fat removed, like, must be, like, dead inside, basically. Like, it's the symbol to him of the absolute kind of, dearth of meaning. People have nothing better to do with their money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, almost, like, maybe
well,
even the
older,
people can't be bothered to exercise. They're going to get their
older,
fat sucked
older,
out.
Older people, they're doing this instead of taking care of themselves or whatever.
But isn't the whole yuppie thing supposed to be other Gen Xers? Like, there's the Gen... Like, Tobias is a yuppie, and they're, like...
The word is, you know, used imprecisely. I think from our point in history now, yuppies would refer to the boomers in the 80s who were becoming careerists and consumers and stuff.
But I think yuppies are by definition young. I mean, the Y in yuppie stands for young. Like, I think they're talking about...
Well, it was from yippie, which was a version of hippie, and that became yuppie.
But it stands for young, upwardly mobile professional.
Right. I just think the time it was first used was to describe boomers in the 80s, I think. So we can continue to use it for each, you know, group coming after or whatever, mm-hmm. right?
So I guess we don't know who he's talking about there, whether he's talking about people their age or people older.
So this book is describing, bohemians in the early 90s, who don't know what to do with themselves, really. They're looking for meaning, they can't find it, so they settle on hanging out, t- telling each other stories, searching for unique, interesting aesthetic experiences instead. Now, that is like something that is probably quite true of young people in the early 90s, partly because of there is a pretty severe economic downturn. Mm-hmm. But by the time the mid 90s come around, many of these, you know, Gen Xers, they're educated professional class people. It's clear, right? They're very cultured. They, you know, what happens to a big chunk of them is they go into the tech industry because the internet is becoming really big in the 90s. And so Douglas Copeland says himself that many of his art school friends ended up working in exactly that, in tech. And so Copeland's kind of next book that was, I think, considered pretty important at the time, or what widely read, published by HarperCollins, it was called Microsurfs. Hmm. And it was about exactly those Gen Xers. These were coder, but not just any office workers. They were coders working at Microsoft.
Okay.
And Microsoft is named.
Okay.
I couldn't believe that he didn't get his pants sued.
So Microsurfs, like, it actually means Microsoft.
It's a play on surfs. Microsoft, okay. Right? And so the critique of these guys is that they do nothing but work. They live in cramped houses with roommates that eat terrible food. In other words, they live an aesthetically disgusting life. And there are attempts to show that these are they're serfs, like they're slaves to Bill Gates, who, it does appear, as a ghostly presence in the book, like a roaming authority figure. When you get into it, you're like, oh, they're doing this because this is incredibly lucrative. What you find out that many of these people are millionaires or millionaires-to-be because they have stock options in the company. And so you're like left wondering, okay, well, these are basically, in the end, I guess my point is, these Xers that we see in the early 90s in Generation X, by the time Microsurfs comes around, what we're seeing actually is their upward mobility and them becoming... maybe they're unhappy, but they're extremely wealthy.
But at what cost, I guess, is the question that he's trying to very hammer on the head.
They're highly paid professionals by the time the mid-90s roll around.
Sure.
So maybe that's, in a lot of ways, kind of what happens to Generation X as well.
I wish it would happen to me.
Yeah, it depends if you wanted to. If you wanted to work in computer... If you had done your own startup or something, that would get bought by Google.
I don't think I really know what a startup is, unfortunately.
Yeah. So it's funny because, like, the problem for those microsurfs, it's a cultural problem.
Yeah.
So they don't get to have an aesthetically pleasing life. Like, that's kind of their problem.
Well, and so it sounds like they don't get to have a meaningful life or a life with any kind of juice. So I just want to give this book credit, because I do think that it really did spawn a lot of interesting followers. Mm-hmm. And I mean, who knows, right? Who knows if these books would have existed anyway. But it's credited with really inspiring, or at least opening the door to writers like Chuck Palahniuk. And I know I'm probably saying that wrong, but the author of Fight Club, which people often say bears a kinship. Readers see a similarity there. I think, like, Fight Club is probably a lot more... dense. I mean, Chuck Palahniuk's a really talented writer, whether you like his writing or not. Mm-hmm. And obviously that was an extremely successful movie as well. And then there was Trainspotting again, Irvine Welsh, who also went, like Chuck Palahniuk, wrote many books, all of which were celebrated, and kind of looked at this generation, although in a slightly different way and mm-hmm. in a different part of the world. But if Copeland can be said to, like, kind of have spearheaded a literary genre or movement, or at least kind of thread mm-hmm. with Generation X, then, I mean, the book deserves credit for that. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I mean, he coined, or he popularized, the term Generation X, which is now completely ubiquitous.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
And like we said, it is very zeitgeisty. He does capture something that's not made up. Like, he did capture something real, which is why the book resonated with people, probably.
The book it's a vibe, right? The book is a feeling. So I would say, to give the book credit to, the prose is, like, at times stylistically interesting.
Yeah.
At its best, it's entertaining, it's sprightly, and it has, like, snappy metaphors and similes. Mm. So here's an example. Dag stares at his feet. He gazes at them like they were two keys on a keychain, but he can't remember what locks they belong to.
Yeah, that's
I thought that's a great metaphor. And so there are really quite dazzling moments like that.
Mm-hmm.
And but they are moments, right? Mm-hmm. And just and just moments, because again, it's this book is like a collection of moments that never feels like it adds up to something. And of course, people who defend the book, they would say, well, that's exactly the point.
Yes.
It's a feeling of purposelessness, of pointlessness, and fragmentary aesthetic experience that the book is trying to relate. And so I understand that. I totally understand that. I guess I just, from a book, at least now, at this point in my life, I want to be entertained.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't find this entertaining, maybe partly because it's just dated now. Mm-hmm. Maybe it felt more, like it felt fresher or more original at the time. Like, probably did, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I also think that, entertained, also immersed, like, emotionally, psychologically, in that way we're talking about, where the characters feel like real people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think, you know, like, Fight Club, Trainspotting, those are books where the characters are all differentiated. The dialogue is, like, I mean, Irvine Welsh is, like, a genius, you know?
Dialogue, yeah.
Yeah, and just that voice.
Yeah, and you know? So I don't feel like any of those markers of achievement in a literary work are really hit on here. Mm-hmm. Like, you can do these things as well as portray a fragmentary experience. Like, you can do both.
Yes, you can.
And he's not doing both, really. Yeah. I feel like he's not, but...
But, I mean, maybe if this book, I mean, if it weren't so celebrated, then we wouldn't be holding it up to such a high standard. You know, if it didn't hold the place in culture that it does,
mm-hmm.
then it would be a fine book.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it holds such an esteemed cultural position that you can't help but hold it to a higher standard.
That's right. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Any other comments by way of conclusion here on Generation X?
I mean, reading it again, this time I felt, you know, other works that we've revisited, or artists that we've revisited, mm-hmm. I've found, like, myself to actually give them more of a chance than I did before.
Yeah.
Like, that's been the general, rule for me so far. And this time, no, I really felt like there was less there than I expected.
Generation X, overrated.
Yeah.
At the time, it was overrated,
yeah.
I feel. But Copeland has gone on to write many books since. He has a flourishing career in visual arts. Mm-hmm. He does, like, sculptures and objects. I believe he had something to do with these colored lights that are on a tower in Calgary that I've recently noticed.
Oh.
And I think I read something about I don't know what he did. He designed them, perhaps. He certainly didn't install them himself. But I don't know if you've noticed this in the Calgary skyline. There is, forget what building it is, but it has new colors on it.
Oh, okay.
And I think that has been
his I'll take
doing.
A very careful look at that when
All
we
right,
get
thanks,
back
Douglas
to Calgary.
Thanks, Douglas Colvin. He did prove the skyline. This is a city that I think the characters in this book, Generation X, make fun of, actually.
You know,
they make fun of Alberta.
Oh, yeah, of course they do.
It's a very snotty thing to do.
Yeah, this should be obvious to me, especially because I work as a ghostwriter.
Yeah.
But the artists can actually, like, hire people to do, like, all the physical work for them. And the example of this she gave is Douglas Copeland. Like, she was like, yeah, of course, he doesn't do any of it. Like, he is like, I want it to look like this, and someone else makes it. And I was just like, what? But, I mean, I guess it's fairly normal that people...
Yeah.
like hire assistants or whatever. It's not that, like, an architect doesn't, like, build the building that they design. It's not that heinous when you think about it. And, like, I don't think it's heinous that I'm a ghostwriter either, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it was very interesting to hear that. I at the time I was shocked because I thought being an artist meant making the art physically.
No. No, and
that was just naive on my part.
Yeah.
But the Douglas Copeland, like, made these, like, just made, was the artist behind these, like, extremely extravagant works. And I was like, oh, so he, like, climbs the tower, puts the lights on, or whatever. Like, that was my, you know, naive assumption.
I think he made an object for an opening of a Canadian Tire that is just a bunch of tires stacked really high.
Okay.
He did a brand of clothing with Roots, a clothing line that was called, like, Roots X.
Really?
He's doing this stuff still. So he's very much hustling. He's out there selling his, using his cultural capital to continue to have a career. All right, Naomi. Well, that was, I feel kind of bad for ragging on this book, but I mean, Douglas Copeland doesn't care.
I don't think it's going to harm him.
Okay. Well, thanks for talking about this book with me. And thank you to everybody for watching and listening. And we'll see you next time.